Well, good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and it's an honor to have as our guest this morning Judge John Denson. The judge is a practicing attorney in Opelika, Alabama. He's the author of The Cost of War, A Century of War, many wonderful papers. Look at his archive on lourockwell.com. He's famous for his library. His library covers many areas, but especially the area of war and foreign policy. We'd love to have him on to talk about some of the important books he's read. John, why don't you start off this morning by telling us, how did you become a non-interventionist?
Well, it's a personal story of gradual progression toward that idea. I wasn't born that way, but I did learn that way. And I learned early that by taking the position of non-interventionism and armed neutrality that Washington and Jefferson advocated and we adopted as American foreign policy for 100 years, you will be bitterly criticized and you will be accused with the pejorative word of isolationism and appeasement. So I've learned that the best way to counter that is that they say isolationism is what caused World War II because we failed to join the League of Nations and then we appeased Hitler at Munich. My strong advice to those who believe in non-interventionism is to use that word rather than isolationism. And here's the reason is you need to be careful with words. Confucius is said to have advocated in 500 B.C. that you can lose your liberty by corruption of language and the meaning of words. And there's a interesting paragraph in this new book by Clyde Wilson and Brian McCallahan called Forgotten Conservatives of American History. But I'd like to just read you this opening paragraph because I think it's important in this connection. Several times in his dense treatise, John Taylor of Caroline, the systematic philosopher of Jefferson and democracy, warned the political terms are treacherous and the exact meaning must be examined with care because words are themselves weapons in the eternal campaign for designing men to achieve power and exploit their fellows. Let them control the terms of the debate and you will already have conceded defeat. So I think that it's very important to use the word non-interventionism and armed neutrality. My defense goes like this. You start with World War One, and you say it was our entry into World War One that made that into a war that ruined the 20th century. I've always said if America had not entered into World War One, there would probably have been a peace treaty. There would have been no Treaty of Versailles and so forth. And the unlikely witness you can call to the witness stand to support that idea is none other than Winston Churchill. In a very unguarded moment in 1936, he came to America and was interviewed by a man named William Griffin, who was editor of the New York Inquirer. And Churchill, who is probably more responsible than anyone to getting us into World War One and World War Two, said this. He condemned America. He said, America should have minded its own business and stayed out of the World War. Of course, this was in 36, so it wasn't World War II, so he didn't say World War One. Should have stayed out of the World War. If you hadn't entered the war, the Allies would have made peace with Germany in the spring of 1917. Had we made peace then, there would have been no collapse in Russia followed by communism, no breakdown in Italy followed by fascism, and Germany would not have signed the Versailles Treaty, which has enthroned Nazism in Germany. If America had stayed out of the war, all these isms wouldn't today be sweeping the continent of Europe and breaking down parliamentary government. And if England had made peace early 1917, he said, it would have saved over a million British, French, American lives, end quote.
I wonder why he said that.
I think that's because that's the truth. And I guess he didn't know it was going to be quoted, and you won't see that in any history books.
No, that's for sure.
But you will find it. I wrote an article about it on lourockwell.com, published in April 11, 2008. But it's in a book that I highly recommend. It's a series of books by J.F. C. Fuller entitled Military History of the Western World, Volume 3, page 271. So it's,
well, he was a truth teller in general, Fuller.
Yeah, Fuller's great. That you'll find it, but you won't find it in any history books in any of our schools because it's a very embarrassing comment. I mean, he got us in there, you know, tricked us in the Lusitania, and he tricked us in with the Intrepid in World War II. So it would be a very embarrassing public statement now to America's foreign policy to have Churchill tell the truth about it. But that's the defense for non-interventionism. You start with World War One, and don't let them start when the debate that you're an isolationist and we should have signed the Versailles Treaty. In regard to non-interventionism, I have a book here that I've recommended, Target Switzerland, Swiss Armed Neutrality in World War II by Stephen Holbrook. What's surprising to me is that he recounts the story that Switzerland, they believed in federalism for 700 years. And what I found in reading constitutional history about the founders of the country, they used Switzerland as sort of the example for federalism, local government, cantons, and armed neutrality. And they, big sport in Switzerland is target practice. They're known as the great shooters. And they used to be hired as mercenaries. In fact, the king of France hired them to try to protect him during the French Revolution. And they've now passed a law that the Swiss can't be mercenaries except for the Vatican. They yes. still are the armed guards for the Vatican. So those are my beliefs, and there's some others. The first casualty of war is truth. The winners usually write the history by using the propaganda that was used before and during, and it becomes the history. And that you can lose your freedom by winning wars. That was the theme of the book we did called The Cost of War in the conference, that my theory is that the American government, by winning the war between the states, Spanish-American War, World War I, we completely changed America. We destroyed the Republic, the war between the states, and we destroyed our foreign policy with the Spanish-American War and World War I, and have been on the wrong path ever since. I don't believe in pacifism or unilateral disarmament. Of course, Murray Rothbard wrote a great article in The Cost of War where he said there were two just wars in American history. One was American secession from England, which was not a revolution. We weren't trying to take over the government in England. And the other was a Southern secession, an attempt to secede from the American government, which again was not a civil war. It was a war of secession. We weren't trying to take over the government in Washington. Those are some of my beliefs and how I came to believe them. I've had several people tell me, well, what did your father teach you that, or you, so forth. And oddly enough, my family has been engaged in all the wars. My great-grandfather was a captain in the Confederate Army. He was captured and put in a prisoner of war camp in Ohio for a long time. My father fought in World War I in France. My first cousin that I practiced law with for 50 years was a pilot of the B-17s that flew from England and bombed Germany. My first cousin, Charles Rush, that I'm going to talk about later, won the Navy Cross as a commander of a submarine in the Pacific. My second cousin, Gene Sledge, wrote two great books, and he fought in the Pacific. And my brother-in-law was a graduate of West Point, fought in Korea. And it's not that my family has never participated in wars. I came to these conclusions by reading and investigating these ideas, and they're certainly my views. As a child, born in 1936, so in 1944 and 45, my brother and all these relatives being in the war, I thought war was just the most glorious thing in the world. I played war every day. My brother sent me a parachute even. I thought about jumping off the house and see if it worked. And my best friend's brother was a P-47 pilot. So we played war every day, and I thought this is the most wonderful thing in the world. And we had a prisoner of war camp here with 3,000 German prisoners of war. And my father, at night, was air raid warden, walked around at night, made sure everybody's lights were out so the Germans wouldn't bomb us. So it was very exciting to me.
Did the Germans, by the way, have planes that could have reached Opelika?
No, don't think so.
No. So it's just to keep the civilian population in with the war effort, right?
That's right.
It was same with the rationing and many other things.
That's right. It was to propagandize the war and think, you know, we got to support this thing because they could be here bombing us any day. And I thought that, you know, I thought when we went around, my father wore this white hat with an armband signifying he was an official, and he had a flashlight. We went around to make sure everybody turned all their lights off. And every night I expected the bombs, you know. I thought, shoot, you know, we've got German prisons here. This is, and I've got all this family involved in the war. And it was glorious. I played war every day. Thought it was wonderful. And so I told you, I was going to tell you the steps that sort of started my thinking. The first was when I was 11 years old, my cousin Gene Sledge, who was fought in all the major wars in the Pacific, Okinawa and so forth, was going to come to Auburn University. And He was going to school. He hadn't finished his college career, and he was going to live with us. And I could hardly wait. I mean, I wanted to hear all about the wonderful stories. And so my parents pulled me aside, and they said, now listen, he's had a very difficult time. He has these horrible nightmares and screams out in the middle of the night. and about the war. Whatever you do, do not mention anything about the war in front of Gene Sledge, because he's had a horrible experience, and I could not believe, you know, it's like taking a kid into a candy store and saying, you can look, but you can't take anything. So I never asked him anything about it, but I began to wonder, is, you know, how glorious is war if it's going to have this effect on a soldier that was in it? I mean, he was in hand-to-hand combat. So the second step was when I was in high school, the Korean War was going on, and I expected that I might be in that war. And in 1952, I took my first sort of interest in politics, and I heard Senator Robert Taft comment that it's an unconstitutional war. We never had a declaration of war. Truman was relying on the UN, and Korea had invaded America, Pearl Harbor. Am I going to fight in that war, and why? I mean, what's going on? So that was sort of the second step. The final step was I had gotten interested in politics in the 1960 presidential race with Kennedy and Nixon, and so I'd started reading and joining organizations. I came in contact with the Ayn Rand group, and that's how I got to know Mises. She was recommending Mises. It has Rampart College with Bob LaFave. Had a lot of books, and so I don't know where this
came. By the way, his library is at the Mises Institute.
I know
we have the whole Rampart College library.
What a great
papers thing.
And for those that don't know it, well, it was the college was located in Colorado,
yes,
wasn't it? And
formerly the Freedom School, and then they changed it to.
And students would go there and stay for a week, so it's sort of like the Mises mm-hmm. Institute does.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got all the audio tapes that came out. This is back when you had magnetic
yeah.
tape, you know. And it's probably where I got the tape. But I got an audio tape with Percy Graves, who had is the husband of Bettina Graves. And he had been hired by the Republicans to do the research for the Pearl Harbor investigation by Congress in 1946. And so he had a lot of knowledge. So I listened to this tape, and that was the first time I'd ever heard the story of Pearl Harbor, about how Roosevelt provoked it and how kept the knowledge from the commanders at Pearl Harbor. And I thought, this can't possibly be true. This is treason. I mean, why have I never heard about this before? I listened to that tape many, many times, and it just was sort of a life-changing event. I mean, is this true? How could it be true? And all these people be misleading us all these years.
I might just mention that Percy's widow, Bettina, still going strong. She edited Percy's book on Pearl Harbor, and she's working now. She took notes through all of she was Mises' personal assistant. She took notes throughout all his seminars, and she is in her 90s, and she just told me the other day that she's very proud to be the oldest person in her retirement home. So, and she's just an astounding lady, and still doing important scholarly work. So just
yeah.
a great person.
Well, she
person.
Is quite a lady. I remember I had a little get-together at my cabin at the lake, and she came to it, and she must have been in her 80s at the time, and she put on a bathing suit, went swimming, and had a wonderful time with all the kids, and she's a real trooper. I mean, she's very bright and just a wonderful lady.
So when you get to know her, you understand what Mises saw in her.
Yeah. That tape I listened to in about 1961 or two. And I don't know when he made it, because his research was all done for the 1946 congressional hearing.
Yes.
That led me to read a great book by George Morgenstern called Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War. He was a writer for the Chicago Tribune, and he covered those congressional hearings. And that book is still pertinent today, and it tells the whole story in detail about Pearl Harbor.
You know, it's interesting, just as a small aside, they had immediate hearings on the whole Pearl Harbor question. 9/11, nothing for a very long time, and of course they did their best not to have anything, and they ended up having phony hearings. These were slightly phony, but they were less phony, shows how where the country has gone, than the 9/11 hearing.
Yeah, the vote was made after the 46 hearing and went right down party line votes. The Democrats said that the commanders at Pearl Harbor were responsible and defending Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kimball and Short were unprepared. And the Republicans said no. Said Roosevelt and Marshall were at fault. They hid the information. They knew that the Japanese were going to attack. And they hid all this information from the commanders. So it was a surprise in Hawaii, but it was no surprise to Roosevelt and Marshall in Washington.
Right.
So Morgenstern is very good on all that. But then there's another book I recommend that's fairly recent called The Pearl Harbor Myth, Rethinking the Unthinkable by George Victor. I think the best book, recent book, Day of Deceit by Robert Stinnett, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And he did that many years of research and got through the Freedom of Information Act and got all kind of documents. And it is very authoritative and is very, very convincing about what Percy Graves had seen at the congressional hearings that the Republicans are probably right about.
But Stinnett defends Roosevelt, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
He defends the fact that he hid it all and because it was so important to get the U.S. and fool the American people into the war.
Stinnett points out that that Roosevelt contacted a Navy man who had grown up in Japan and asked him to prepare a document for him on how to provoke the Japanese into attacking. The guy was in the Navy, grew up in Japan, had missionaries, fathers, knew the culture and so forth. He drew up an 8-point plan about how to provoke the Japanese into firing the first shot. And Roosevelt followed each one of them, moved the support of the Navy away from, leave the Navy exposed in Pearl Harbor, cut off the oil, and all these things. And Roosevelt met with this man and followed his program on how to provoke the war. And so it's a very revealing book. I recommend it highly. The Pearl Harbor story just sort of blew my mind. That how can history be so false about this? And how can the government hide all this from us? And that's when I developed my interest in revisionism and World War One. And, you know, at that time, historians were sort of the leaders in freedom, whereas today it's sort of the economists. But there were some great writers that started revising and telling the truth about World War One. Charles Tansel is one of the main ones, Charles Beard, Harry Elmer Barnes, Ralph Rako, so forth. So I've recommended all of these books in the recommended reading list of the books that I've written. And they really sort of destroyed the whole myth about created by Wilson about why we should have gotten into World War One. And the book that that really sort of sealed it for me was the book called The Lusitania by Colin Simpson. And he tells the story about how the Germans found out that the passenger ship, the Lusitania, was getting ready to sail from New York to England. And they were loading ammunition and supplies in there that made it a legal target for the German submarines. And so the German embassy went to William Jennings Bryan, who was Secretary of State, and said, you need to tell President Wilson about this and warn Americans to stay off that because that ship is going to be fired on. And so Bryan went to Wilson and told him about this and asked him to issue a warning. But Wilson wanted into the war so he could create the League of Nations, so he refused to do it. So Bryan went back to the German embassy and they said, well, we're going to run ads in the New York papers and warn people about this. And there were people in Congress, Senator Gore and House McLemore, trying to pass resolutions to try to get a warning out of this. And so the Wilson refused, and of course the ship was sunk. It goes into much more detail about that. It was clearly a war that it was an event that could have prevented America from getting into the war because that created a hatred for Germany, and they felt that they're firing on an innocent passenger ship, but in fact they were transporting armed armaments, and that's why when the submarine fired the one shot, it was a second huge explosion that sank the ship, and that was the ammunition on board that was illegal to be carrying. So that was a big thing. And then
one of Rothbard's laws was nobody ever resigns. But William Jennings Bryan did resign.
He was so upset.
I've always forgiven him his crazy monetary stuff because he did that. I thought that was...
Yeah. And he got great criticism for resigning, but he just thought this was clear deception of the American people to have this warning given in advance and then Wilson refusing to let the people know and letting them be killed. So then the study of World War One led to the study of the Treaty of Versailles, which was the most Carthaginian treaty ever made. And so that helped solidify my views. My advice to people in coming to that is to make a study of the causes of the war and see if it was a just war, and then make a study as to the result. Peace, was it a just peace? Because unless you have a just cause and a just peace, you don't have a just war. And the Treaty of Versailles was a horrible treaty that needed to be revised and peacefully and eventually revised by force. That sort of led me into just looking at all American wars and looked at the Mexican War of President Polk intentionally placing American soldiers into a disputed area about the, what is the boundary line between Mexico and America. And he intentionally put them in there so the Mexicans fired the first shot. And then, of course, I've written in the Century of War an article called Lincoln in the First Shot, where Lincoln provoked the South into firing the first shot for Fort Sumter.
The tax collection office.
Yeah,
right. Terry. Nobody ever describes it that way, but that's what it was.
There's another war that needs to be studied more because it is really distorted, and it was a very important war, but it's praised, and that's the Spanish-American War, and that's praised in our history books as a great, noble war to free the Cubans from Spanish rule. And there was a lot of support for that. Mark Twain supported it in the beginning, a lot of other people, so freedom of liberation war. But unknown to the American people, McKinley was a subscriber to what's called the Lodge Policy, and he wanted to conquer the Philippines. And so he gave orders to Teddy Roosevelt, who was Assistant Secretary of Navy, tell Commodore George Dewey to take the Navy to Kong and wait until war was declared. And then you go to Manila and sink the Spanish Navy. Well, Commander Dewey thought this was sort of the same thing about Cuba. We're going to free the Filipinos from Spanish rule. So he encouraged the rebels, led by a man named Aguinaldo, to participate and run the Spanish out. And, of course, that wasn't McKinley's idea at all. And when he heard about it, he told the Navy, told Dewey, you stop that. Then he ordered that the guns be turned on Aguinaldo, and they started murdering the Filipinos by the thousands. There are all kind of estimates, but it is separated in history books from the Spanish-American War, and it's called the Philippine Insurrection. And so
they, how dare they have an insurrection?
They, I think, about 5,000 American soldiers were killed in the Philippine insurrection. I've read various numbers, but 15,000 to 20,000 Filipino soldiers and almost 100,000 Filipinos. And so McKinley took over the Philippines as a dictator and ruled the Philippines. And so when there's a famous quote from Mark Twain where he says, when he turned against the war and the anti-imperialist league was formed to oppose the insurrection, and he said, you cannot have a republic in America with an empire in Asia. And so we took over the Philippines and the Guam and Puerto Rico. So it was an aggressive war and not a great war of liberation just for the Cubans. And that's very distorted in history.
I remember after it all, Mark Twain proposed changing the U.S. flag to replace the stars with little skulls and bones.
Yeah. I've forgotten that. That's right. Because I've already talked about Pearl Harbor and World War One. I want to talk about, let me mention one book, a very good book on the Spanish-American War, and it's by Walter Karp called The Politics of War. The subtitle is The Story of Two Wars Which Altered Forever the Political Life of the American Republic, and it's the Spanish-American War and World War One. So it's a good write-up on the Spanish-American War and the truth about the Philippine insurrection being a war of aggression by America on the Philippines. Let me mention one more book on World War Two. This is a book that's just come out recently called The Chief Culprit, Stalin's Grand Design to Start World War Two by Victor Suvorov. And I remember you telling me several years ago that this same author wrote a book called Icebreaker.
Murray Rothbard was fascinated by that book. And
Icebreaker.
Yes, Icebreaker. And he'd always thought that the Russians were the victims. But it turned out, of course, that Stalin was the aggressor. But it's like two scorpions in a bottle, right, two sides. And many of the American non-interventionists argued that they should just be left to fight each other, and the U.S. had no business. But this Icebreaker book, I'm sure this newer edition, based on all the Soviet archives, I mean, unlike in this country, of course, nobody can go into the American archives except what they want to let you have. But there was a period in the Soviet Union after the collapse when all the archives were available to scholars, especially guys like this who, I think, is he a KGB?
He was.
KGB general or something like that?
Well, he was almost out of high school. He was trained to be an intelligence officer, and he was so brilliant and so knowledgeable about things. They led him into the archives that went all the way back. This is while he was in Russia. He eventually defected.
Yeah.
But he gained all this knowledge while he was loyal to the KGB as to why Lenin wanted another world war. And Lenin took the position that communism could not be successful after World War One unless they had a World War Two. So Stalin subscribed to that. And so the title Icebreaker comes from the fact that they decided that the plan to how to start World War II, for Russia to start World War II, was to arm Germany after World War One, because they had been disarmed by the Versailles Treaty. And so Lenin said, we've got to rearm Germany. And that's what's always been a mystery to me, is how did why did Russia let Hitler rearm secretly in violation of the Versailles Treaty? And then why did they go with him jointly into Poland? And, of course, like you say, people then said, well, poor Stalin, Hitler turned on him and so forth. But the plan of Lenin was that the only way communism is going to succeed in eliminating private property and capitalism is for the capitalists to have an internal civil war among themselves. And we're going to use Germany as the icebreaker to start it. And there needs to be a war between Germany fighting England, France, and America. And when they get so debilitated, then we will come in and attack Germany and take over.
And even before Hitler, the Soviet army was very, very friendly to the Wehrmacht, which was limited to 100,000 troops and very limited in its armaments. And they were supplying armaments and doing, you know, and being pals of the German military.
Exactly.
Very close allies. So this, of course, explains why that was.
Yeah. It explains a lot of the mystery of how that all that got started. But Hitler learned while he was at war with England that Russia was getting ready to stab him in the back and attack him. And he was going to now have the two-front war that he thought he had avoided by the agreement with Stalin. So he sort of turned around and left England alone and attacked Russia first. And he had not planned to do it at that time. You know, he didn't think he was going to have to. But Stalin, he learned that Stalin was getting ready to attack him. And so the Russians moved all their forces up to attack. And all of a sudden, Hitler turned on him, much to the surprise of Stalin.
And apparently they had no defenses whatsoever. Everything was set up to be offensive.
They moved all
so
the
that
offense.
When Hitler invaded, just a knife through butter.
And he goes into a lot of that in this book. The chief culprit, Stalin's grand design to start World War II. So, you know, we are constantly fed the information about Hitler starting the war, and it was Lenin and Stalin had always planned to start World War II and use Germany as the icebreaker to start it, and then they were going to conquer Germany. So it gives you a whole new revisionist viewpoint of World War II. And this guy's very knowledgeable. He was had access to all the archives back when he was loyal to Russia. This is not something he discovered after World War II. He was looking at the archives for the purpose of the Russian government and learned all this a long time, before the archives became available to historians today. So it's a very revealing book, and it shows you how World War II came about.
Eric von Knut-Ledin did an analysis of German voting patterns when Hitler was elected and discovered that the strongest areas of support for Hitler were the communist areas. So even in the early 1930s, there was still some kind of, maybe just because these are such similar philosophies as well as other reasons, but the communists were Hitler's strongest supporters.
Well, that's he was going to be the icebreaker, and then they were going to turn on him and stab him in the back. So it's a very interesting book that is fairly new. Turning to the Vietnam War, there's an excellent book to read that's very disturbing called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam by Nick Terse. It discloses the My Lai massacre as something that was not isolated. The Viet Cong had infiltrated South Vietnam and dressed as the peasants, so you couldn't tell who the enemy was. So in order to get the enemy, they got orders to just go in and kill everybody in a village. Anything that moves, kill it. And people were promoted and given benefits by the number of people they killed, regardless of who they were. So these whole villages were being wiped out in South Vietnam. And I knew a retired lawyer in my hometown that I worked with. It was a veteran of Vietnam, and he was given this order. And he went into a village and was supposed to go in this hut or house, and something moved, and he shot and it was a 14-year-old boy. And that memory haunted him to the day he died. This lawyer I knew died, going to his grave thinking that he had carried out that order to kill any that moves. So it's a tragic thing and gives you some idea.
But about, I thought we were protecting freedom.
Yes. That was the idea. So, finally we get to the awful Iraq War and all the lies that were told by George W. Bush and his people and tricking Colin Powell into going to the UN talking about the wars of mass destruction and so forth, possessed there, and then making a preemptive strike, which was, sort of against our foreign policy. And there was no declaration of war by Congress. Turned it over to the president, use his own discretions about it. So those are some of my ideas in support of why I think we need to be in the framework of the founding fathers, that we should have a non-interventionist foreign policy and armed neutrality and no entangling alliances. It was a great policy. It was not isolationism. They wanted trade with everyone in the world. These are some of the ideas and strategy I would suggest for people to use to support non-interventionism.
And no special hatred for any foreign country and no special attachment either.
Right. Washington specifically said you will have no favored nation status for people, which we do today. We favor a few people very strongly and carry out what they tell us to do is in the Mideast. So, we violated every good advice our founders had about foreign policy, and it's led to the militarized state and approach the police state in America. Foreign policy has been used to take away our freedom. Winning wars has been the way we've done it. That's a very foreign idea to a lot of people. They think, we are all support all our wars, that the soldiers out there protecting our freedom, and we're really causing other nations to hate us, and that's where the phrase blowback comes from. The terrorists of 9/11 is a blowback operation. And people just don't want to believe a lot of these truths about the lies that American history tells them and how much is hidden from the American people about the truth of war.
Well, John Denson, thanks a million for coming on today. As usual, you're so interesting. And if people listening have not looked at John's archive on LRC, you will start one article and you're going to find you're reading every one because they're so well written and just so fascinating. We're going to link to all the books that John has talked about today. And John, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Lou. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.